Well, it's good to have you in here. How long will you be in the States?
3 weeks altogether in North America, a week in Canada.
So are you doing an actual tour?
Yeah.
Whereabouts is your tour taking you?
New York this week, and Washington, Philadelphia at the end of the week, then Toronto, and Madison, San Francisco, Boston.
How about Ithaca? Are you going to trace some of the Volkoffs of old haunts?
I've done that several times, yeah.
I imagine, yeah. Yeah. Well, let's talk about the Volkoff and about how you came to write the book. Let's see. Why don't we start with Nabokov first, and maybe as some background, you could just give me kind of a sketch of Nabokov before he came to America, which was, of course, in 1940. He was born to a very wealthy family, wasn't he?
Yes, his parents were, well, his mother was a millionaire, certainly, several times over. His father wasn't exactly so wealthy, but his father had been the Minister of Justice under Alexander II and Alexander III, so they weren't poor by any means. But it was really his mother's side that brought in the wealth. They had mines in Siberia, and Nabokov himself inherited an estate that was worth £2 million sterling back in 1916. So Lord knows what it would be today. In fact, there's some talk of the family home in St. Petersburg, which was in the ritziest street in St. Petersburg, being returned to the Nabokov somehow, if under the condition that it becomes something of a Nabokov memorial.
What about his education?
He had a phenomenally lucky education. His father was a very, very cultured man, and his mother was an avid follower of all the latest poets. She passed on her passion for poetry to Nabokov. He learnt English from the age of about two. He was fluent in French by the time he was five, and he was reading the best literature in those languages between the ages of 10 and 15. So he'd read all of Shakespeare in the original, all of Flaubert in the original, and all of Tolstoy in the original by the time he was 15.
He published a book of poems at a very young age, too, his first book. Tell me about that.
That's right, yes. He began to write poetry in 1914 in a very serious way, although he had been dabbling before that. This was when he was 15. And in 1915, he met his first real love and began to write verse for her. He was writing a poem a day, virtually, and published the first of his volumes of poetry in the summer of 1916 with some of the money he'd inherited from his uncle. His father thought it was rather a silly idea, but it couldn't stop him. He was paying for the production himself.
He started collecting butterflies very young, too, didn't he?
Yes, he was an avid lepidopterist from the age of seven or eight, and had a mammoth collection already before the revolution that he had to abandon in St. Petersburg. When he went to the Crimea, he collected southern Russian butterflies, had to leave that collection there. Then he went on to Europe and discovered a new species in the south of France, and then came to America, and well, that was the fulfillment of his butterfly dreams, because he discovered lots of new species. He worked for the Harvard Museum of Comparative Zoology and so on.
He was a chess player.
Yes, he wasn't a great chess player, but he was a very interesting chess problemist. Boris Spassky liked very much some of his problems. But as a player, in fact, he was certainly not of phenomenal ability. He really preferred to have the time to create problems that were interesting, complex, witty, and so on. And facing somebody in a moment-by-moment situation, he was too fanciful, really, to cope.
His father died very violently under strange circumstances. Tell me about that.
His father was a leader of the Cadet Party, the Constitutional Democratic Party, Russia's leading liberal party. And after the revolution, when he was arrested by Lenin, had to manage to get out of prison and flee towards the south of France, then settled in Berlin, where he set up a newspaper that was basically a Constitutional Democratic Party paper. In 1922, he was welcoming from Paris Paul Milyukov, who was the other foremost leader of the Constitutional Democratic Party in exile. Milyukov was speaking in front of a large audience in Berlin when somebody rushed up from the back and cried out for the Tsar's family in Russia and shot at Milyukov. Nabokov's father, who was sitting in the front row, leapt up onto stage, grappled with the gunman, and got him on the ground, whereupon another gunman came up from the back and shot Nabokov in the back through the heart, and he was killed instantly. At the trial, the two assassins said they were as happy that they got Nabokov's father as Milyukov.
How did Nabokov, young Nabokov, react to this? What impact did his father's violent death have on him?
He was devoted to his father with an intensity that's hard to imagine, both his parents. And there's a very, very poignant diary account of the night he heard about his father's death. He was in Berlin on holiday from Cambridge at the time. And it's just heart-rending. And for years after, he was still devastated. I think even in fiction, as late as Pale Fire, 40 years after the event, he still returns to that day and the tragedy of his father's death.
Nabokov left Russia. Tell me about those circumstances.
The family left St. Petersburg in 1917, just immediately after the revolution, partly out of fear that Nabokov and his next oldest brother, Sergei, would be conscripted into the Red Army. So they headed straight off for the Crimea and were joined by the rest of the family, who remained there until April 1919, when the Crimea fell to the Red Army. The Nabokovs just managed to escape because Nabokov's father was Minister of Justice for the Crimean Provisional Government. He and other members of the cabinet of the government were held up by the French authorities, who had been holding the Crimea. They wouldn't let them board the ship that they wanted to board for fear that some of the funds of the government were being absconded with by members of the executive. But it wasn't the case. But because of the series of misunderstandings, it wasn't until the Bolshevik forces had surrounded the harbour that the Nabokov family got on board the boat, and there was machine gun fire strafing the harbour as Nabokov and his father sat on the deck of the Nadezhda playing chess.
Nabokov settled where?
He went with his parents to London in the first instance, and he studied at Cambridge. Then his father found that he couldn't really do much for the liberal Russian cause in England, so went to Berlin, where the emigration was assuming enormous proportions. There were something like 400,000 Russians in Germany in the early 1920s.
But Nabokov did go to Paris, right? And he lived in France, where he wrote much of his Russian language prose.
He remained in Berlin, though, until 1937, which is quite surprising, given the fact that his wife was Russian-Jewish.
Is that where he met his wife?
Yes, in Berlin. Mm-hmm. And the greatest part of his output was actually written in Berlin. He moved to... He was living in a very cozy little part of Berlin. Of course, they were appalled by what was going on around him, but he had managed to have very little to do with the German world outside. When he did escape to France, the conditions there were very, very difficult. He wasn't allowed a work permit, and the family really were quite destitute there. And he had been trying for years, in fact, to get out of continental Europe into England, into the US, Canada, India, South Africa, anywhere where he could, anywhere in the English-speaking world, basically, and hadn't found an outlet. And it was only after years of trying in France that he managed to get to the US at the very last minute, just as the German tanks were rolling across northern France towards Paris.
That was in 1940, but he had already developed quite a reputation. He had written by that point the Invitation to a Beheading in the Russian, right? So he had developed a reputation before he left for the States.
Yes, very much so. He had a reputation by 1929 as the foremost of the younger Russian emigre writers. That was with his third novel. He was immediately, people like Ivan Bunin, the first Russian Nobel Prize winner, said that Nabokov had come along with a gun and shot us all of the older generation off. And it was one of Nabokov's tragedies, really, was that he had to leave behind this reputation as the bright young light of Russian literature and enter the U.S. completely unknown, because emigre literature was regarded as very suspect and remained so, in fact, for a long time, partly because of the success of Soviet propaganda. And it's really only in the last 10 years, and especially in the last six or so, now that that emigre literature has been made legal inside the Soviet Union, and the Soviet Union is proclaiming emigre literature as the saving grace of Russian literature in the 20s and 30s, that Nabokov's, the magnitude of Nabokov's contribution to Russian literature is being realized.
Well, here we are in 1940. This is where the second volume of this magnificent biography begins. He really had problems, though, in coming to the United States in terms of economics. He had to obviously work for a living. His wealth had long dissipated. He got a series of college jobs at places like Wellesley and so forth. But it was really kind of hand-to-mouth at first, wasn't it?
Yes, and in the emigration in Berlin, he had managed to support himself just by language lessons, private language lessons. But at that stage, his wife was also able to work as a secretary, and they didn't have any children. By the time he reached the U.S., he had a six-year-old son when he arrived, and he realized that it was going to cost him quite a good deal of money to put him through the kind of education that he wanted his son to have. And yet, he wasn't able to find a permanent job. He had one-year renewable appointments, well, possibly renewable appointments at Wellesley all the way through the 40s, virtually until 1948.
Taught for a summer at Stanford?
Yeah, and he also worked at the Harvard Museum of Comparative Zoology, but that gave him very little money. It was very satisfying for him, but gave him almost nothing.
But he finally got a tenured spot at Cornell.
That's right, yes. And although he was appointed there, as he thought, as part of the Russian department, there actually wasn't the Russian department, as he found out to his great chagrin. About 2 years later, he thought he was the head of the Russian department, but in fact there wasn't one.
And indeed had stationery printed,
yes,
reflecting that fact.
That's right.
Which he had to throw away.
Yes. But once he switched, once he realized the basis of his position there, and that he needed to teach European literature in general to get any kind of promotion, he switched to teaching his famous masterpieces of the novel course that ran from Jane Austen through to Kafka. And that proved enormously popular, became the second most popular course at Cornell.
It was in the early 1940s he wrote his first English language novel, The Real Life of Sebastian Knight. He made a conscious effort to switch to English for the rest of his life, didn't he?
That's right, yes. Actually, it was before he moved to the U.S. that he began The Real Life of Sebastian Knight. He wrote that in Paris in the winter of 1938-39.
He must have been anticipating the move, huh?
Well, he had been trying for years to get out into the English-speaking world, and he realized that with the advent of Hitler, the chances of the emigre community surviving were almost nil, and that there just wouldn't be a market anymore for his Russian fiction. The market had been very meager anyway, but it would be completely dissipated. So he switched to English. This was partly after having supervised the translation of the novel Despair into English and realizing that he could actually do a better job than the translator. And so he rewrote Laughter in the Dark, which he'd written in the early 30s in Russian, and expanded it into an English version, which was published in the U.S. in 1938, and then that year began a new novel from scratch, The Real Life of Sebastian Knight. But he had a great deal of difficulty getting that published once he got to the US. He had a very low opinion of US publishing after his arrival because nobody wanted it. It was just too original.
He became a very close friend to Edmund Wilson, a friendship that later was strained. Tell me about that. Edmund Wilson, we should say, was probably the foremost critic of the 1940s and 50s.
Yes, he was very lucky to meet Wilson so early in his American years. Wilson at that time was passionately interested in Russian literature, and so he was quite happy to pick Nabokov's brains as much as he could. And he had a very high opinion of Nabokov at that stage, thought Nabokov was perhaps the most brilliant person he'd ever met, and expected him to write one of the great 20th century novels. They actually collaborated together on translations from Pushkin and Nabokov. As a rule, just abhorred the idea of any kind of collaborative project. And I talked...
But ultimately it was a translation that separated them.
That's right, yes. Yes, in 1964, when Nabokov's four-volume translation and commentary to Eugen Onegin was published, Wilson wrote a devastating review, or what he intended to be a devastating review, in the New York Review of Books. And it was really very much an ad hominem attack, which was rather curious. And their relationship had been getting more attenuated for years. And it seems likely that the prime cause of the rift between them was a sense of jealousy on Wilson's part. His Memoirs of Heckett County was banned in 1947 for its sexuality, and it had been selling well, and suddenly the sales stopped completely. In 1958, Lolita was released in the US, and because of the scandal around it, it went straight to number one and sold more copies in the first weeks than any book since Gone with the Wind. And Wilson found Lolita difficult to read, difficult to abide, I think, and he virtually stopped writing to Nabokov shortly afterwards.
It was a breach of professional ethics. It's always a breach of professional ethics to review a friend's book, or a former friend's book, as the case may be. Not supposed to do that. There was a long article in the New York Observer about a week or two ago. I don't know if you saw it. I don't know if you're familiar with the Observer.
But, yeah.
It was a long article about... Well, I dealt with a review of Harlot's Ghost by Norman Mailer, the review written by John Simon, who has had a long-time feud with Mailer.
Mm-hmm.
And the question is, I mean, if you're going to give an enemy a review, can you expect that review to be fair? And so, I mean, the article questioned that a lot. So at any rate... Obviously, the review that he shouldn't have written the review like that. He really shouldn't have done that. It's just not ethical.
On the other hand,
Wilson was a breach of ethics. Maybe not so much then, but it certainly is today.
Well, Wilson had so many contacts in the literary world. It was and he was a very good reviewer. It was hard for him to find people that he didn't know, and major figures.
Yeah, but they had a long, ongoing relationship. I mean, they visited each other's homes and they had dinner together. I mean, that was a little different than having a passing acquaintanceship with someone.
But he always felt, he certainly never felt constrained at all by friendship. He rather liked picking faults in friends' writing. It didn't constrain him at all. In fact, I think he was rather charmed by his capacity to find faults in his friend's work. It was very curious.
Well, that's a kind of a sidebar. Well, let's go on. During this period, Nabokov began doing major research on the North American butterfly and began to organize the species. And a lot of original research. He spent hours and hours and hours on this, didn't he? He was not just a collector, in other words.
No, he was... He hadn't done any scientific dissection and so on before coming to the U.S., but he had known the recognized butterfly species of the world by the time he was 10, and had a passionate eye for detail and his extraordinary memory, and he did superb articles on the butterflies he collected in various parts of Europe before he came to the US, but he was particularly delighted when he came to New York. It was the first time he really managed to get into the dissection side, into classification of species. He was working at the American Museum of Natural History and then went on to Harvard, and there it had always been something of a mania for him. I'm sure that some of the obsessiveness of Humbert in Lolita is a kind of reflection of his own recognition of his obsessive side about butterflies, for instance. And he was working there up to 14 hours a day at the microscope, and had to get glasses very soon because of that intense effort. He knew it was paying woefully, and that it was hindering his production of literary work, but he was just so besotted with the excitement of the discoveries that he was making that he couldn't stop.
Well, at some point, he began to write a novel tentatively titled Kingdom by the Sea, which was about an older man's obsession with a young girl. This, I guess, was the origin of Lolita, is that correct? You go into great detail. I think that's the largest section of the American Years, the chapters dealing with Lolita. So tell me about the origin of that book.
He had begun to write a novella on this theme of an older man's obsession with a young...
Of course, he did write a book called The Enchanter,
yes,
which I read a couple of years ago.
In Russian.
That was very similar.
In its initial premises, it was, yes, a man marries a woman for access to her 11-year-old daughter, but it was set in Paris. The woman was physically ailing, about to die, and it stops immediately after the man tries to violate the girl on their first night together after the mother's death, and the man is killed. When the girl wakes up in horror and screams, he rushes out onto the street and gets knocked
over. It should
over.
Be pointed out that The Enchanter, that is correct.
Yes, that's right.
Was not published in Nabokov's lifetime.
That's right, yes.
It was discovered, I think the manuscript was discovered much later by Dmitri.
Oh, I found it, actually.
You found it?
Yes.
But I had talked to Dmitri at the time that book first came out. So you discovered the manuscript among his papers.
Yes, yes. I was asked to sort out the archives back in 1979.
And that was a real find, wasn't it?
Yes, yes.
Were you given credit for that in the... introduction?
Yes, I think I was, yeah.
Yeah, that was some year, 88, I believe. That
it was 86 in France. I thought it was still 86 in...
It might have been.
I think
I can tell. Because I don't, like Nabokov, I don't throw anything away.
Mm-hmm.
86, my notes, December 8th, 1986.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, here. In my notes, I should have read these. Then Brian Boyd, a scholar working in a biography in Nabokov, organized archive material and located The Enchanter.
That's right.
I wrote that myself.
Vindicated.
I wrote that myself when I made notes from my interview. So soon you forget.
Yeah.
So much knowledge to retain. Well, let's go on in the book with Lolita.
Yes.
He did write the book, but did submit it to a number of publishers without success.
Yes, he was very well known by that stage in American literary circles. He was one of the New Yorker's star writers by that stage. He actually had a first reading agreement with the New Yorker, and he submitted it to Catherine White, knowing that she couldn't possibly accept it for a magazine like that, and then submitted it to publisher after publisher, and each of them said, "This is wonderful stuff, but we can't risk publishing it. We could go to jail." And... in the end, he had actually at that stage planned to publish it anonymously. He was very, very worried about the kinds of repercussions that might accrue to Cornell, where he was teaching. And he had said that he had just written it for his own satisfaction. He didn't care about publishing it. This was as he was writing it. By the time he finished it and realized how good it was, he was adamant that it had to be published, and he took it to, well, he submitted it to his European literary agent, who handed it on to Olympia Press, which he was unaware of the reputation of. He didn't know that it was, that it published not only serious literature, but was basically known as a pornographic press. And fortunately, Gerodius of Olympia persuaded him to, at the very last minute, to publish it under his own name. And if that hadn't been done, it would have been very hard to defend the book's literary standing in America. But
of course, he did get a very good endorsement from Graham Greene.
That's right. And yes, it was really Greene who set the ball rolling for Nabokov. At the end of 1955, he named Lolita as one of the three books of the year in an English paper, and a right-wing morals crusader read the book on Greene's recommendation and started a campaign against the book. And Greene started a counter-campaign, a very witty one. The person who started the initial campaign was John Gordon. Greene and a lot of other London intellectuals set up a John Gordon Society to issue little bands to put around books, banned by the John Gordon Society, and suggested the certification of offensive ceramics and so on. And by that stage, Lolita had begun to become a cause célèbre, and also the French and English governments got into the business. They were in cahoots over Suez at the time. The English government was embarrassed by the kerfuffle about Lolita and asked the French government to ban Lolita and all the other Olympia Press books at that time, which became a public outrage in France that they should be banning. Some of the books on the list were already published in France in French by Gallimard, which was notoriously fussy about sexual standards, and yet the French government had capitulated to this English request, so it became a kind of international scandal.
A little bit here, almost out of time, but it did create a lot of interest in the United States, and a number of publishers were interested but couldn't work out an agreement with Olympia, which actually held the copyright.
That's right, yes. Gerodius was demanding more than 50% of the royalty money, which was absurd for secondary rights, and for that reason, there was one publisher after another backed out of trying to secure the book. By that stage, the climate for books dealing with sexually risky matters had changed since the early 50s, and publishers weren't nearly so alarmed. And also, the U.S. customs officers had seized the book twice and released it, which indicated that there wasn't going to be governmental opposition to it.
So finally, Walter Minton of Putnam stepped in and did publish the book.
Yes.
And it became a bestseller.
That's right, yes. Extraordinary way.
Major incidents. I think as you write, the public library in Cincinnati banned it, which is not unusual.
Probably
very good for sales.
I think, a Los Angeles library banned it, and sales immediately shot up again. They'd been flagging in Los Angeles, and they shot up again there. But, yes, nothing major at all, and that just a little bit of publicity of that kind just kept the sales humming along.
But Lolita is not a salacious book. There's no profanity. There's no direct obscenity that one might consider obscenity in the book. Is there? It's the theme of a passionate obsession by an older man for in effect the child.
Yes, but I don't think it's just the theme. I think if the theme had been handled at more distance, it might not have seemed so shocking. But the really uncomfortable thing about the book, and I think Nabokov meant it to be uncomfortable, is that you're inside the mind of Humbert. You're trapped within his mind, and you're partly seduced by his way of putting his case. He's very, very persuasive. I think ultimately a good reader will recoil from him, but you're made to be complicit in a way that you don't want to be at all. And it's the fact that you see it from inside his seething passion that makes it so powerful a book.
Well, so the Lolita solidified Nabokov's reputation. He was able to leave Cornell, went back to Europe, but he went back to the United States to go to Hollywood to work on the screenplay. That was not one of his high moments, was it?
You mean that the screenplay wasn't magnificent?
I think he remarked that he didn't recognize too much of his own book in the screenplay.
Well, yes, He spent 6 months working on the screenplay, but the first version he submitted to Kubrick, Kubrick said would take 6 hours to run, so he cut it down by half. And then Kubrick said to him that this was magnificent, this was the greatest screenplay ever produced in Hollywood. Then went with his co-producer, holed up in an office for a month and rewrote it almost completely. And Nabokov was very upset when he saw the finished movie to see how little of his screenplay was used. He was given credits for the complete credits for the screenplay when the movie was released, but that was primarily
based on an original story.
But screenplay by Vladimir Nabokov too, because Kubrick and Harris were concerned that there might be objections to the movie. They'd toned it down so much anyway that it bore very little relationship to the book, but they wanted Nabokov's name on the screenplay because he had that kind of literary kudos by then, and they thought that was additional insurance.
Well, the money from the motion picture and the royalties gave Nabokov a lot of independence, and he and his wife settled in Europe again, in Switzerland. I think you write that he intended to go back to the United States, but never did.
Yes, he felt an enormous allegiance to the U.S. almost from the moment he arrived in New York in 1940.
And he became a U.S. citizen.
That's right. And he certainly had no intention in 1959, when he went over to Europe, of settling there. He was going to see his sister in Geneva, to see his son, who was beginning to study opera in Milan. And It was really just a long series of accidents that made him stay in Europe. His son remained in Europe for quite some time. And by the mid-60s, Nabokov was in his mid-60s and had just settled into to life in Europe, had become engrossed in the composition of Ada. He didn't want to move while that was underway. By the time he emerged from that, he was nearly 70, and it was just getting very difficult physically to uproot himself.
When he was 76, he had a bad fall while hunting butterflies, and that almost, I think you point out, marked the beginning of the end for him.
Yes, he was extraordinarily fit in his early 70s, still doing a lot of butterfly chasing in the Swiss Alps. But this particular fall that he had, he didn't break any bones or anything, but people who knew him well did say that he was never quite the same afterwards, that he seemed to have lost focus in his eyes, or just didn't seem to have quite the same life in him. And certainly after that,
he was nearing 80.
Yeah, 76, yes. He was...
After that point, he'd been quite productive, both in his translations and his fiction, as well as his butterflies.
That's right, yes. He was being published several times a year in the U.S., really, with his new English fiction, his revived Russian fiction, novels and then stories and collections of essays and so on. Just book after book was coming out in the mid to late 60s and the early 70s. And he was wrapping up his early career with various kinds of compilations. And it was only after that fall and a series of rather unidentifiable viruses that he began to slow down in 75, 76, 77 when he died.
Now, Brian, why did you undertake this massive biography when there is an official biography by Andrew Fuchs, was authorized by Nabokov?
Field advertised it as official in 1969, several years before it, well, about 8 years before it came out, but by 1973, when he submitted the manuscript to Nabokov, things had changed radically, and Nabokov was absolutely appalled at the errors and insinuations all the way through Field's book, the unfounded speculations, the facile mistakes and so on. And they were pretty soon communicating only through their lawyers. In fact, the Nabokovs tried to get Field to change all sorts of factual errors and so on. And it wasn't until 1977 that Field's book came out. The existence of Field's book was, in fact, a good lever for me to get Vera Nabokov's permission to tackle the biography.
Really. So, in effect, you also have an official biography. I mean, even more official.
It's not official in the sense that
you were allowed to go through his papers.
Yes.
The family allowed you to go through all the papers and the archives and everything.
Yes, which were closed to other people, certainly. And in that sense, yes.
Had Nabokov ordered his archives locked for 50 years?
That's right, yes. The archives that he gave to the Library of Congress were banned, or sealed for 50 years, except... if one got a special dispensation, I managed to get that in 1980, even before I began working on the biography, in fact. But, so it's never been considered an official biography, but I've always kept in mind Vera Nabokov's sense of things, and sometimes I've disagreed with it, but I've certainly respected the privilege of having the access to the papers.
Is Field still around?
He is, yes.
Have you heard from him?
We had an exchange not quite in the TLS. I reviewed his book he did a revised version of his book published in 1986 after he heard that I was underway with a large-scale biography. And he came out with his in very short order, hoping to spill a few more beans, but in fact they were all even wilder speculations in that book. And I slammed that fairly conclusively in the TLS. He then published a paperback version of the book in England. It never appeared in the US, with a new preface called The Nabokov Mafia, in which he slung off at me. He didn't want to name me, but it was fairly clear who he had in mind. And since he hadn't replied in the columns of the TLS to my review there, and since he put an advertisement in the TLS for his new book and its devastating preface, The Nabokov Mafia, I replied to the preface in the TLS, and he didn't reply to that. I think it was a bit too devastating. When he got the year of the Russian Revolution wrong twice in two consecutive books.
You learn not to trust him. But you were born and raised in New Zealand, is that correct?
I was born in Belfast, Northern Ireland, actually, but I've lived in New Zealand since I was five.
Since you were five. How did you stumble onto Nabokov, and what made you interested in him?
My parents had a little rental lending library in a provincial New Zealand town, and I picked Lolita off the shelves, knowing its reputation, and when I was about 13, and hoping for a thrill, and finding myself mostly pretty puzzled, really. I read the book through, but I didn't get any great sense of excitement from it, literary or otherwise, and then in 1969, Time magazine did a cover story on Nabokov at the time of Ada's publication. And I was just fascinated by everything he said in the interviews there and by everything that was cited from Ada. So I went to the local library to get the latest Nabokov I could find, which was Pale Fire. And I read that through in a state of utter bliss. This was my last year at high school. And I've been hooked on him ever since, really.
When did you decide to embark on this massive project?
Well, I did my PhD at Toronto on Nabokov. And I had sent a couple of chapters of the PhD to Carl Proffer of Artist Press in Ann Arbor, who was a Nabokov scholar and a friend of the family by that stage. And he sent those chapters on to Vera Nabokov. And I heard back from him that she was very excited by what she'd seen. And so I sent her the whole thesis when I'd finished. And she promptly invited me to come and visit her in Montreux. I was about to go back to New Zealand at that point, so I rerouted myself. Instead of going across the Pacific, I went across Europe and spent 4 days with her then. And 2 months after I got back to New Zealand, she wrote inviting me to come back and sort out the archives. So I was teaching in New Zealand at the University of Auckland at that stage. And in my summer vacations, I came back to Switzerland to go through the archives. And
it was more than archives, too. You traveled all over. You went to Russia.
Well, this was still before I was doing the biography. See, I was working on a kind of bibliography that would give the biography in through the back door, because of the field experience, I didn't think she would countenance another biography. And I was trying to get access to more materials in the archives that she hadn't yet let me see, such as Nabokov's letters to his mother. And she said to me at one point, "Why do you need to see things like this? When you're only doing a bibliography, of course, if you're doing a biography, I would show you everything." And my heart flipped, and I said nothing then, because I was just beginning to teach and had a lot of teaching preparation to do. I didn't have the time to consider a project like this, but I applied for a scholarship, got it, and then wrote asking, reminding her what she'd said, and she's a very, very private person indeed, and hesitated about allowing me to do the biography, even though I had been working there for a couple of years on the archives.
Did Nabokov maintain a journal?
He had a diary that, but it was really an agenda book.
Because you have so much detail about where they go on the vacations and the cabins they stayed in, and even hotel room numbers and things like that.
Yes, well, I don't think I actually cite hotel room numbers. Nabokov did in the preface to one of his books. After reading Field's book and seeing how much error could creep in, he decided to do a bit of overkill and cited room numbers himself. But Vera Nabokov also kept some kinds of diaries and a sort of list, evaluation of the motels that they stayed at in their first trip across the U.S. And I think that I cite that partly because it becomes grist to the mill of Lolita. Certainly Nabokov's extensive travel through the motels of the West when he was chasing butterflies gave him invaluable background for that amazing motel section of Lolita.
Well, Brian Boyd, we're almost out of time, but perhaps you could put your thinking cap on now and kind of speculate as to Nabokov's reputation in the future. He came very close, we assume, toward being a Nobel laureate. That didn't happen, of course. But where is, in the annals of literature, where is Nabokov going to stand in the future?
I think he'll stand with some of those other 20th century writers who didn't get Nobel Prizes, like Tolstoy and Chekhov and Proust and Joyce.
Conrad.
Conrad, I don't care for, I must confess. And Nabokov certainly didn't like the comparison because Conrad had never been a writer in Polish, whereas Nabokov's greatest grief in his professional life was that he had to abandon the Russian that he had made such a supple instrument up until the beginning of the 1940s, had to abandon it completely and his reputation. I think he'll be recognized as one of the great 20th century writers.
And will be
in Russian and in English.
But is the reputation going to be based solely on Lolita?
No, I don't think so. I think, in fact, it's not my favorite Nabokov novel. I think it's very fine, but I actually prefer Pale Fire and Still. And I think books like Ada, The Gift, and Speak Memory are on a par with Lolita, too.
Well, this is a magnificent biography, and so big, of course, it had to come out in two editions, the latest of which is the American Years. Brian Boyd, thank you very much.
Thanks very much.